This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Will we experience serious sea level rise during our lifetimes? How about storms bigger than anything in recorded history? All this is suggested by a controversial new paper published in March by an international team of scientists, and that was led by the famous former top NASA climate scientist, Dr. James Hansen. The short title of the paper is Ice Melt, Sea Level Rise, and Superstorms. To get another opinion, I've contacted Dr. David Archer. David is a professor in the Department of Geophysical Sciences at the University of Chicago. I learned a lot from his excellent book, The Long Thaw, How Humans Are Changing the Next 100,000 Years of Earth's Climate. David also helps moderate the scientist blog called Real Climate. David Archer, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Thanks to be back.
What was your role in this Hansen paper? Could you explain what a reviewer or a referee is?
Yeah, traditionally, you submit a paper to a journal and the editors solicit some reviews and look at them and, you know, you get to see them yourself and it helps you to re-improve the paper and the editor uses them to sort of decide whether to publish the thing or not. This paper was published in a sort of a new online kind of format where the editors did solicit reviews from a few people, myself included for this one, but it's also open so that anybody who wants to can leave a comment. So this paper got a comment trail that was just incredibly long. Lots of people putting in comments, some of them useful, a lot of them kind of nuts.
Okay. Well, in your book, The Long Thaw, you wrote about polar ice melt that would take thousands of years, and now the paper by the Hansen Group suggests melting could happen much faster. What is your reaction?
Well, even 10 years ago when I did The Long Thaw, it was pretty clear that there have been instances of sea level rise in the past, like the Heinrich events, which the current, even the generation today of ice sheet models can't really simulate or explain. So I always sort of expected that as we understood how ice sheets behave better and as the models improve, our, you know, expectation of how long it would take for them to collapse would get faster. So I'm not at all surprised by this, actually.
And can you help us understand the doubling time argument made in this new scientific work?
Yeah, so the simple view would be to say that the rate of an ice sheet melting is just going to be driven by whatever temperature it's at. So that would be a sort of linear response that, you know, 1 degree of warming might get you this much of a melting rate or 2 degrees might get you that much. But what Hansen is proposing, and this is not totally a new idea, is that the act of the ice sheet melting may enhance the conditions for its own melting so that it would, once it starts to go, it would be a runaway process. So the way it works is that the meltwater from the ice sheet runs into the surface ocean around the ice sheet, and it's fresh, so it's buoyant, less dense than the seawater that it's running into. So it acts to stratify the water column so that the surface of the ocean around the ice sheet gets colder as the ice sheet is melting, but then there is heat that's sort of trapped a few hundred meters down below the surface, and that warming of the subsurface water is in contact with the grounding line of the ice sheet, so it makes the ice sheet go even faster. So these Heinrich events that happened during the last ice age, they occurred kind of embedded within these abrupt climate changes called Dansgaard-Oeschger events. So there would be like 3 or 4 oscillations of temperature in Greenland from these Dansgaard-Oeschger events, and they would get more and more extreme. And then finally, at the coldest cycle of the whole envelope of cycles, that's when the Laurentide ice sheet would suddenly collapse and dump vast amounts of rocks, ice-rafted debris on the seafloor. So it was always weird. Why would this thing melt down when it's cold? You'd think an ice sheet would melt when it's warm. But Hansen is getting indications of this mechanism both from 3 different sources. One is from climate models today. Another is from observations of the real ocean today. And the third is looking at paleoclimate reconstructions. And it's kind of the raggedy edge of all of those different kind of modes of learning about the world. The the ocean models that we have, and the one that he uses in particular in this paper, probably overestimate mixing in the ocean. So when you dump fresh water into it in the model, you probably don't get as strong a response as you would in the real ocean, because mixing doesn't happen as quickly in the real ocean. There's mixing for numerical reasons. Then the other part of the modeling story would be the ice sheet model, but there isn't an ice sheet model that we can, you know, tickle the grounding line with 2 degrees warmer water and watch it collapse. That's beyond our capabilities yet. So the modeling is kind of like half there. And then for the observations, there is evidence for sort of an anomalously cold patch around Greenland that may be part of our weird omega block weather in this country, possibly. And there's also this weird thing that the sea ice in the Antarctic hasn't been decreasing as much as the models had been predicting that it should. So it might be changing because of greenhouse gases, or it might be changing because of the ozone hole. But you put both of those things in the climate models and you don't get the sea ice persisting in Antarctica the way it has been. And so Hansen is suggesting that it's due to runoff from the Antarctic ice sheet, which is stabilizing the water column there and keeping the sea surface temperatures sort of anomalously cold. And then there's reconstructions from paleo data. The last time the climate of the Earth was sort of analogous to today was 120-some thousand years ago, a time called the Eemian, the last interglacial time. There's evidence for a period of abrupt sea level rise during this time, which he's also kind of incorporating into this story. The really astonishing thing about the modeling results is when you dump this fresh water into the high latitudes, you get this huge cooling in the high latitudes. And maybe we haven't seen that before because nobody's ever dumped this much fresh water into an ocean model before, but really, really strong effect. And the impact of that is to make the planet stormier, because you're making it colder in the high latitudes, and so the temperature difference between the low and high latitudes gets sort of temporarily exaggerated as the ice sheet is in this process of melting down and collapsing.
All sorts of fascinating things in what you just said. Now, I wonder, is it too early to say that these possible changes to ocean currents in the North Atlantic are responsible for that storm track that kept blasting the United Kingdom during the winter, or the recent cold spell that hit the east of North America while the west has been roasting?
Well, there is this weird omega block thing that climate scientists are talking about or trying to learn more about. You know, it's sort of like traditional, you know, meteorology more than climate science, a blocking event. And so it's not a kind of thing that a lot of climate scientists have thought about a whole lot. But between the so-called polar vortex winter and then other things that have happened, you know, more recently, there seems to be this sort of blocking pattern. And so, you know, one possibility is this persistent and growing cold patch that's been documented by my colleague Stefan Ramsdorf off of the east coast of the U.S. But there's also this weird high temperature, they call it the blob, this thing of water off of the Pacific Ocean, off the west coast of sort of Canada. So I don't know, it's kind of in turmoil, it seems like, the opinions on what's causing this strange weather, if it's, you know, even anomalous.
Well, along those lines, one of the critics of this paper is Kevin Trenberth from the National Center for Atmospheric Research. And he raises with me one of several issues is the lack of recognition in this paper of the role of ENSO, better known to the public as the cycle of El Niño and La Niña. Can Hansen reach the conclusions he does without taking ENSO into account?
Well, I mean, Trenberth is more of a climate modeler than I am. I don't actually do climate modeling myself, so I will certainly take his opinion very seriously. I don't have an idea, though, how El Niño could affect, you know, the ice sheets melting. It seemed like the main point of this paper is this positive feedback thing, where once the ice sheet starts to melt, it just sort of slips like somebody falling in a slippery bathtub. You know, once you start going, you can't catch yourself. And I don't know how El Niño would affect that. He talks a lot about sort of heat transport and the bipolar seesaw, that what happens in one high latitude affects what happens, you know, at the other high latitude, like a sort of temperature seesaw. But I don't know how El Nino would fit into that. Maybe he has ideas that I just haven't thought of. I have no idea. But I don't see where it, you know, undermines what Hansen is going for. You know, this Hansen paper is so wide in scope that it's just presents a huge sort of target cross-section for criticism. If I were doing it, I would have cut it way back and kind of simplified and just, you know, one thing at a time. But this paper is like shooting the moon.
Well, maybe really there's amazing. Three papers in there, really.
Oh, easily.
Yeah. How did the discussion go on the blog you helped moderate, Real Climate? Was there criticism there or about the process of publication or the conclusions?
You know, I don't really moderate that site. I just occasionally, you know, contribute something. My sense from talking to people, you know, I'm pretty enthusiastic about this paper, and so it comes up in conversation a lot when I'm, you know, talking to climate people about, you know, what's up. And I think my enthusiasm for it is on the strong end of the spectrum. It seems like there's a lot of criticism of the paper. But, you know, I view it as just, think of a scientific problem that you're developing a model, and eventually the model will give you a perfect simulation and totally answer the question that you're after. The best scientist in that process is going to get to that understanding, you know, first, when the model is still kind of raggedy and you have to be clever about what questions you're asking it and think really hard about what the model is doing right and what, you know, you can't rely on because it's all, you know, kind of raggedy still. You know, that's the genius of this paper.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, climate scientist and author, Professor David Archer from the University of Chicago. Well, yes, the paper from Hansen brings out the possibility of superstorms this century, larger than anything we've seen. How would that work, and do you agree this could happen?
There's a figure in the paper. It shows the jet stream. It shows the east-west velocity of air as a function of altitude and latitude. And you look at the present-day simulation or the global warming simulation without this ice sheet melting thing going on, and you got these two jet streams that are sort of up high in the atmosphere, and they don't really reach down very much. But then panel B of this figure shows where he's doing this freshwater addition from a purported ice sheet meltdown event, and you get this intense cooling in the high latitudes, which makes the temperature gradient stronger. And you look at the little blob of the jet stream on there, and it's like a drip from a kitchen faucet that's sort of dripping down. You see these velocities, and they sort of drip down all the way to the surface. So it's as though the jet stream is kind of, you make it just a little bit stronger, and suddenly it's starting to reach all the way through the atmosphere and down to the surface. So there's a lot of words in the paper describing, and he says that his initial motivation was reading these geological reconstructions of Eemian time from the Bahamas. And he says that with stronger trade winds, there's just, the Bahamas are just getting hammered by these really, really big waves, long period waves that build up across the ocean. So there are various kinds of geological deposit that he's passing on the claim that they were caused by, you know, like a boulder was pushed up by huge waves, couldn't get there any other way, or something called run-up deposits where sand kind of gets shoved up onto the beach by really strong waves and maybe strong storms. So the evidence for really strong storms is sort of twofold. One is the results from the climate model when he doses it with huge amounts of fresh water, and the other are these sort of geological deposits. And, you know, like I said, it's all kind of raggedy edge of what we can see from these various methods now. So what's cool is putting them all together and getting a coherent picture. It kind of strengthens all the pieces. The whole is greater than the sum of the parts. That being said, when I reviewed the paper, I said, you know, you should leave out these boulders, man. Just concentrate on the ice sheet melting positive feedback and keep it simple and sort of think about one thing at a time. And he did reorganize the paper. He totally reorganized how it was laid out and makes it much easier to understand. But he stuck to his guns, and you know, reading the finished version, I can see why he did. It is kind of a masterwork of synthesis, I think.
Well, and the man is getting older. He may be feeling like he's running out of time.
As are we all.
Yes, indeed. All right, well, this paper is so large, it feels almost like an alternative climate report. Does it contain a lot of new science, or is it an alternative interpretation of work already done?
It contains a lot of new ideas about how things can fit together. There are, for example, ideas about how the Southern Ocean controls the CO2 concentration of the atmosphere, which is a topic that I worked on and kind of gave up because nobody has been able, myself included, to figure out how to make a model of the ocean carbon cycle that actually can accomplish getting the CO2 down to the low level that you find during the glacial time. But it is very closely correlated with temperature changes in the Southern Ocean. So Hansen says, okay, there's got to be some link between the Southern Ocean and the CO2 concentration. So, you know, here's how this all would work. And, you know, I'd personally like to see it if somebody could, you know, actually describe mechanistically how that works. I'm sure an ice sheet modeler would have the same response to the paper that, boy, you know, it's cool to see how it could all fit together, but it'd be better if, you know, we actually had all the I's dotted and T's crossed and understood all, you know, all the pieces that go into this synthesis.
So if the 2 degree C safe limit, as agreed at the Paris Climate Talks, is actually dangerous, as this Hansen-led paper concludes, where do we go from here?
Well, I would have never called 2 degrees safe. I would very carefully have not ever said that, because 2 degrees is warmer than the Earth has been since agriculture, you know, or even our species, maybe. So 2 degrees to me always felt like bridge engineers selling you a design for a bridge that is not really all that safe, but they think it's all you can really afford. And actually, in Paris, they said 1.5 degrees. I'm not sure exactly what the target is now. Maybe everybody's a little bit vague. But so 2 degrees we could get to by cutting a few percent per year, kind of to where by 2050 we're sort of 80% done releasing carbon. Limiting it to 1.5 degrees, which we've already released enough carbon to get us to 1 degree now. So 1.5 is not that much further off. And given the fact that we are, you know, getting past any sort of, we're not, like, cutting our emissions at all anyway, really much. It sort of seems to me that eventually what we're talking about is scrubbing CO2 from the atmosphere, which can certainly be done. It would just take energy and the will to do it and a place to put the CO2. And if that happens, the U.S., as we are responsible for a quarter of that excess CO2 in the air, we're going to get handed a big bill, and I personally feel like we kind of deserve it.
So, David Archer, what are you working on these days?
Well, I've got a paper submitted to Climatic Change that says that we were really lucky that the CO2 concentration in the atmosphere in the year 1750 was as high as it was. The CO2 in the atmosphere in the natural state is a very delicate balance of fluxes into and out of the planet. So if the sun had been just a little bit, just a few percent brighter, or if we had come to sentience, you know, 500 million years later in Earth history, or if we were just a few percent closer to the sun, the CO2 concentration could have been lower than it turned out to be. And if that had happened, the climate changes that we're seeing now would have happened earlier in time. So if it had been one-tenth of the actual value, the climate changes that we're seeing now that are arguably motivating us to go to Paris and agree to try to talk about this could have happened back in Svante Arrhenius' time in 1896 when he had a kind of wild idea about climate sensitivity, but it would have been much harder to deal with in that case. So the natural CO2, it kind of like provided a fuse that you light the fuse when you discover coal, and then it burned for 200 years before the bomb went off. And it could have been a shorter fuse, so we were really lucky.
It doesn't feel so lucky right now, but do tell our listeners about your free online climate course. How's that going?
It's great. I have two of them now. The second one is kind of an additional thing. So the main one is on Coursera.org. It's called The Science and Modeling of Climate Change. And they start a new cohort of students, I think, every month. So there are online models, and you get to interact with other students. There are peer assessment assignments and discussion forums. And so far, well, last time I checked, about 50,000 people had signed up for these classes. for free online MOOCs like this, the percentage of people that actually do the work and finish is never very high, and that's true for mine too, but a lot of people are doing it, and it's really very satisfying. The second one is a Python programming course that I just launched a few months ago for climate science.
I have no idea what Python is.
Oh, it's a programming language. It's all the rage now among young people. It's free, and it's got all these packages, so you can do all these fancy plotting, and it's not fast like Fortran, so you can't use it for actual climate global circulation models, but it's great for, you know, just doing little things.
So, as we wrap up, David, is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
Stay cool. Stop burning CO2. We can do this. I mean, it seems hopeless sometimes, but if it had just turned out that if we were just running out of coal now, if it had turned out that the planet just didn't have as much coal as it turns out to have had, it wouldn't be an energy problem. We're very smart about coming up with ways of you know, making money. It would just be a business opportunity. So in my mind, the climate problem, the only difficulty here is making the decision.
We've been speaking with Dr. David Archer, the well-known climate researcher and professor at the University of Chicago. David has several books out, including The Warming Papers, The Scientific Foundation of the Climate Change Forecast, and The Global Carbon Cycle from Princeton University Press. You can read many of his posts in the science blog Real Climate at realclimate.org. Find links to David's work, including videos, in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. David, thank you so much for helping us out again.
This has been great, Alex. Thank you for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.